Welcome to this session of the Futures Foundation Futures Forum. Our guest this evening, Oliver Freeman, is a long-time friend of the Futures Foundation. He's director of the Neville Freeman Agency, which he co-founded with Richard Neville in 2001. And he also co-founded the Global Business Network Australia with Professor Richard Borden and Dr. Richard Hames in 1992. He's acknowledged as having done more for the uptake of scenario planning in Australia than any other practitioner by guiding over 400 people and organisations through GBN Australia's scenario planning simulation training programs. For example, Oliver has directed the Australian Business Foundation Alternative Futures Project and undertaken scenario projects with organisations as diverse as Queensland Cotton, Rockhampton Enterprise, NRMA, Pacific Power, Telstra, and the University of Canberra. He's also a publisher, a profession he entered in 1967 as an academic rep from McGraw-Hill in the UK. He's past chairman of Publish Australia, the Copyright Agency Limited, and the current chairman of University of New South Wales Press. He's past vice president of the Australian Publishers Association. Academically, Oliver has an MA from the University of Oxford, and an MA from the University of Essex, all of which means he is eminently qualified to talk with us today about the development and use of future scenarios. Over to you, Oliver.
Thank you very much indeed, Charles. It's a great delight to be here. I've been on this journey in the what I call the foresight journey for something over 20 years now. And if you'd asked me in, say, the mid-80s, even earlier, let's say the early 80s, if you'd asked me whether I would be spending most of my life in Australia, in Sydney, in Australia, and acting as a foresight consultant, I would have looked you between the eyes and said, "You're completely daft. There's no way that I would ever be doing anything like that." And the reason I'm telling that story is because it's the uncertainty of the lives we lead and the uncertainty of the future that drives the need for foresight. And what we try and do when we're using alternative future scenarios as part of a future journey is to create a situation in which we can sort of try and capture the essence of this uncertainty, but give it a framework which we can use creatively and strategically as we go forward. I'm just going to start with a question which is, what are facts? About 10 or 12 years ago, I was running a workshop in Chinchilla, which is a town way west of Brisbane. And the Chinchillians, if that's the way they refer to themselves, were really interested in how they might benefit from the exploitation of mining, which was going boom-wise in the area. And my job was to twofold. One was to act as the chair of the first day, where we had lots of interesting people to speak, and the second day to run a community workshop, sort of responding to what we'd heard on the first day. The first speaker was a mining engineer. And he got up and he said, "Ladies and gents," he said, "it's really, really important that you know the facts." He then proceeded to list, reasonably eloquently, a load of opinions about the role of mining in Australia and what his company was trying to achieve. And so the first thing that we do in the work that I'm involved with is to be rather cynical, or maybe a better word would be sceptical, about what are the facts. Now let me give you, I'm showing an example here of a map that was created 300 years ago, or thereabouts, in the US. And this map was given to me by Peter Schwartz, who was the co-founder of GBN in the US, and one of the world's leading scenario planners. And it's an interesting map because when you look at it carefully, you see that California is presented as an island. And you look at it again and you think, but that can't be true. And we know, obviously, because subsequent to this particular time, we've discovered that California is not an island. And in fact, this was discovered quite a hard kind of way. Some people were leaving the West Coast, heading east, and they decided to take their boats with them. And they got to a beach, a really nice beach, a lot of sand, and then they went forward looking for the water. But of course, as we know, the sand went on forever and the water never came. A similar story exists in Australia, where a guy, and I'm afraid I've forgotten his name, but he set off from roughly Adelaide, going north, and he took a boat with him because he was absolutely certain that there was water reasonably nearby, inland. So the importance of this story is that if you ask people about maps, they assume, and we assume, that maps are true. And the reality is that all maps are abstractions. If you look at a map of the world, actually the world doesn't look anything like that. If you want to be, you know, if you want to get it right, if you are interested in the facts, the whole process of mapping is based on abstractions, which are subjective. They're workable, they're useful. The best example I could give you off the top of my head is the famous London Underground map. London doesn't look anything like that map, and yet we all assume that, you know, it does, and in fact we find the map very useful. On this line, there's one of my favourite stories is about newspapers. And what I've discovered over the last 50 years is that whenever I read something in a newspaper I know anything about, it's wrong. Now, it may not be wrong enormously, you know, substantively wrong, but it'll be cosmetically wrong. There weren't 8 people at the seminar, there were 12, and so on. And the irony in this story is that whenever I read something in a newspaper I don't know anything about, I assume it's true. And this is another example of the bind we get into when we are trying to get our head round the facts. One of the facts that people like to get hold of is the idea that the future is at the end of a trend line. What this means is that, you know, people have a view that if we're going forward, what we really need to do is to look at the past, and the future will be a version of where we have been. I'm now showing another, this is again a thanks to Peter Schwartz, another interesting piece of information relating to a company which was providing spare parts and bits and pieces for oil rigs. And during the 70s and 80s, they put together 3 scenarios about the future. And the scenarios were based on guessing, predicting the number of active rigs over the period in question, which is about 10 to 15 years. What was interesting is that they had their least number of rigs was around the 2,000 mark, and their best guess was something around 8,000 rigs. And then they had a second scenario, which was 6,000, and then a third, which was just below that, probably something closer to 5. So this was these were 3 scenarios that they built in order to help them define their strategic intent over the dozen years or so covered by this particular activity. So this is what happened. The 3 scenarios I'm now showing are still there, but the actual number of rigs declined over something like a 10-year period from 4,000 to something like 1,000. And so their 3 scenarios were completely useless. The reason this happened is because the Congress changed the tax efficacy of drilling. So if you remember Crocodile Dundee, an Australian movie from the early 80s, probably, that was funded on the back of some neat income tax benefits called 10BA, was the name of the actual provision, which meant you could invest in a movie and get a big tax deduction as a result. I think it was 130%. So it was a real encouragement for you to invest in the Australian film industry. And of course, once Crocodile Dundee had been a success, lots of people moved into Australia to do more of the same. Dino De Laurentiis set up a huge production company on the Gold Coast. But of course, what happened in Australia is the same as the story about rigs in the US, is that the government, probably the Keating government, changed the the tax situation. So the incentive to invest in movies disappeared. So here, what we're doing in this part of my conversation is questioning about the you know facts and also looking at the way the future is unfolding and our abilities to try and predict that what is going to happen. I'd like to say one more thing about the whole idea of trends. I have a colleague called Richard Watson. We've just written a book together called Future Vision Scenarios for the World in 2040. And Richard and I are good friends, and we've been collaborating now for some 10, 12 years. Richard had a business which he really, really liked. I'm trying to remember now, it was called something like Brain Fruit. Yeah, I think that, I can't quite remember the detail, but I think you'll find that it was called Brain Fruit. The idea was he was going to give you stuff that would stimulate you and tell you about the way things are changing towards the future. He didn't really do particularly well under this banner. And then he decided to go and focus not on, you know, if you like, the unusual, but to be more predictable and talk about trends. So when he shifted his business focus from brain fruit to trends, his attention went up significantly, and he got a lot more interest from clients. What's interesting about this is that trends are not, and never have been, futuristic. It's one of the biggest mysteries to me that people would want to use trends as a way of predicting the future. Trends are, in fact, the opposite. They're not futuristic, they're pastic or historical. Because what we do when we identify a trend is to trace a particular development back to when it started. So when we look at, you know, the fashion of the 60s, you know, the kipper ties and the platform shoes and the hot pants and all of that sort of stuff. What we do when we talk about the trend, we're in the 60s, we can see the trend, but what we're actually doing is talking about how it started. And we go back to a point before which, and it might be before the Beatles, nothing had happened. The idea that retrospective trend will continue into the future is, from my point of view, totally mistaken. Our next sort of port of call is the idea as to whether the future is uncertain. Now, I've asked this question many, many times. I've done probably 20 major scenario planning projects over the last 20 years. And I ask my clients this question, is the future uncertain? And unless they're deeply philosophical, they will answer yes. And the point about that question is that once you answer yes to the question, is the future uncertain, then inevitably you have to take on board the idea that there is more than one future. And as soon as you say yes, I'm going to be very pleased because I've got you. You're now in my thrall, you're in my grip, because I'm a scenario planner, and a scenario planner is actually basing all his or her activity on the idea that the future is uncertain and there are multiple futures. The question now is, strategically, is what the hell do you do? If the future is uncertain, how do you engage with it? You know, what are the processes that you might want to use in order to take things forward? Well, there are two schools of strategy that we like to look at. There's what we call the getting it right school of strategy, where we confidently extrapolate from the past, we diffidently speculate about the future, and we normatively designate what our strategy is going to be. Then we have, on the other side, the opposite of that, is the not getting it wrong school of strategy. Now, Peter Schwartz, in his book, you know that one.
The Art of Scenario Planning.
The Art of the Long View.
The Art of the Long View.
Yeah, this is old age catching up with me. Peter Schwartz said, and I think it's a really important thing, that the reason you do scenario planning is not to get the future right. It's not to get it wrong. That's what we want to do. We want to be in a position where what happens, we've actually thought about. We may not know what's going to happen, but we've been playing around in that area, so we're not surprised when the whole thing changes. So we make this distinction between in a scenario planning world, you're not concerned about getting it right, you're concerned about not getting it wrong. And we're not either in the denial phase of what we call the non-strategic school of strategy, where you passively await and hope for the best. Okay, now scenarios, are based on a timeline. And we might say in 2015, we might be doing scenarios in a particular area going out to the year 2035. The whole map that we create about the future is like, I don't know if you remember linear programming back in the way when, but the idea of branched programming. So we're not in a position where we're going to say this future or that future will suddenly come into being at this particular point in time. The reality is we move along. We start off where we are now in a world that we sort of understand, and then things will happen which will suddenly take us towards something else. And then that something else there might be another shift, and we're going to a third kind of destination. And the whole point here is that the process by which scenarios come into being is a variegated process along a timeline with lots of branches going off in all sorts of different directions. Okay. Charles asked me to focus on some work we did for the teaching profession way back in 2010. The content of the Teaching Australia scenarios isn't really the point of this evening's discussion. What I'm trying to do is to use it as a way of giving you some idea about the logic of scenario planning. So I'm going to take you through what we did in the open book scenario work, and to try and use that as a way of illustrating the benefits of scenario planning. The first thing we do is to identify what we call the system of interest. And from our point of view, the system of interest when we did this particular piece of work was the Australian teaching profession. And the logic is that we want the people who are members of the teaching profession to reflexively participate in a strategy developing process. We then said, okay, we've got this is a systems approach to scenario planning. Here's the teaching profession. It is set in a bigger environment. So there is an operating environment in which the teaching profession has to operate. And that, by its very nature, is external to the teaching profession. And in technical terms, taking a systems approach, we are really interested in everything that happens on the boundary between the profession and the environment in which it operates. Our next thing is to say, we've got a system of interest, the teaching profession. This is the environment we operate in, which in this case is Australia. We now have within the profession a group of strategists. These are the 60 people we took through this 2-year project. Then they are planning for the future of the profession. So we now have a direction. We've defined the system of interest, the teaching profession. We're focusing on the environment in which the profession operates, and we've got a group of people who want to do something about it. Our next task is to identify the issues currently facing the profession. And we normally generate what we call an issues report based on the conversations we have with people in the profession. Now, it is of absolutely critical importance that this first step is internal to the system of interest. We need to understand what's going on in the heads of the strategists, what they're concerned about, the way they see the world unfolding, what their fears are, etc., etc. And we are going on a journey which is inside out. So we start on the inside, but then we move outside and we say, okay, we've got some understanding of what our concerns are. Let's now look at the influences which are affecting the current environment. And we spend a lot of time on the analysis of the current environment. The next thing we do, I'm going to come back and give you more information on these steps, but once we've identified the influences which might be important in future environments, and we've got the issues that have pushed us to look at those things, we then get into the imagining process of looking at scenarios for the future. And the reason we do that is, you know, going back to where I started, is because the future's uncertain and there's more than one future we need to worry about. Okay, now I'm going to take you through that's what we did with the Teaching Australia open book scenarios. I'm now going to rattle through rather quickly for you the Neville Freeman Agency Quest scenario planning methodology. And there are four steps. Step one is questions. Step two is environments. Step three is scenarios. And step four is transformations. So it's the internal analysis of the issues. It's the evaluation of the external environment. It's the creation of stories about alternative futures. And it's the creation then of strategic responses to those scenarios. Okay. The questions I've already mentioned, the issues report and the sort of process we go through. What will come out of this first step is what we call a framing question, or it can be questions. There is absolutely no point in interrogating the future unless you have a reason for doing so. The interrogation that will be undertaken by a footwear manufacturer in Brisbane is somewhat different from the interrogation that a cattle farmer in Perth or in Western Australia would be undertaking. So you can't build scenarios in a vacuum. The scenarios have to be related to the system of interest and a framing question that you've created together, which will inform you as to why you want to interrogate the future. By way of example, I did some work with a power company in Sydney a few years ago. And to give you a sort of rather interesting framing question, their concern, they knew they were about to be offloaded by the New South Wales government. And what they wanted to do was to try and understand what sort of things they would need to bring to the table if they were negotiating the future for their company in a journey from the public to the private sector. So there was, we had a question around that. And we built scenarios linked on that demand. Now, that is quite a different process from one. I did some work, a scenario project with Aurora Energy in Tasmania, that they weren't about to be privatised. They wanted to know what the hell the future of electricity was going to look like and the impact of their joining the national grid, which was about to happen, and the impact of their loss of being an environmental, very friendly electricity provider because of the hydro which they used in a situation where they would be exporting electricity through the grid onto the mainland and importing dirty electricity, if you like, from the mainland into their country. So this whole sort of quest, the idea of getting the questions right, is really important. In section two, the second stage is the environments. That's where we look at the situation in the external environment and we try and find out what's going on. We've developed a very, very neat tool called Inspect. When I say we, I need to give debts where they're due. The main sort of protagonist with me on this process is Professor Richard Borden, and we've worked together for almost 20 years now at fine-tuning this particular activity. What we do is we have an environmental scanning tool which deals in a normal way, rather like ones which you may know called PEST or September, which look at the natural world, society, politics, culture, economics and technology. And we have a process for scanning the world to see what's happening in those areas that is relevant to the framing question for the organisation that's doing the work. And the thing we've done that is innovative is to put an I at the front and an I that is in brackets. You remember what I was saying earlier about facts? What this says is that whoever the agent is that is looking at the world, they have worldviews. And those worldviews are critical as to what they see. You know, I don't know if you remember back in the 19th century, there was an idea there was an idea that primitive people were somehow pre-logical, you know, that they were sort of innately less intelligent than we were. And the books were published. There were a lot of books published in Victorian England, for example, with you know, showing how innately sort of inferior these primitive peoples were. Along comes Claude Lévi-Strauss, who's an anthropologist, and he says, excuse me, I've just spent, you know, 6 months with the Hopi Indians or some sort of favoured group in the Pacific, studying the way they systematically you know, create language in their pre-logical state. And he discovered with this particular group that they had something like 20 different names for grass. Now, if I ask you how many names for grass you can think of, I think you will get, you might get to two or three. Kikuyu, is that a grass?
Yes,
I think it is. And and I'm struggling now. There's long grass.
Buffalo.
Oh, there's buffalo. Yeah, so I think, you know, we'd have two or three. But 20? How on earth, and why would they need 20? And what Claude discovered was that in their language, they attached a prefix, or it may have been a suffix, I can't remember, but one of the two, to the word grass, which would tell you exactly where the grass was in relationship to the centre of the village. So they had this incredibly complex naming system which would direct you to a particular spot when they were talking about grass. Now, that the reason I'm sort of labouring that a little bit, but the importance of that story is that our worldview means everything. And the way what we see as being relevant in the external environment will reflect the way we see the world. It'll reflect our values, etc., etc. And I'm, you know, in political life, this is the stuff of every day. To give you a view on that, I think it's pretty interesting that almost on the same day, we got a new prime minister in Australia, and a sort of unreconstructed Stakhanovite called Jeremy Corbyn got in to lead the Labour Party in the UK. Now, these two events, they're not particularly connected, but they sort of are in a way, because what they've done in both countries is to put an enormous kick in the bum to the way the world is seen in those places. And there is absolutely no doubt that whatever Malcolm Turnbull does in the future, that his worldview is going to be dramatically different from that of Tony Abbott. I can't vouchsafe quite what will happen in the UK. For the record, because I like to be predictive, I don't think Jeremy Corbyn will ever be Prime Minister, but I do think he's going to mark an interesting and fairly fundamental shift in the political environment in the UK. So that's a long-winded way of talking about the importance of the way we see the world, and it impacts on the way we collect facts. Now, in terms of this process for fact collection, the sorts of things, and the things I'm talking about now are coming back to the open book scenarios, the sort of things that we focused on when we were going through this process in the natural world were things like a volatile climate change environment, the depletion of natural resources. In the social area, the burgeoning of social networks and an ageing society. Interestingly, you know, looking back on this work, which was done probably around 2006, social media hadn't really got going. So even though we were, you know, indicating there was some interest in social networks, we really didn't have a clue what was coming up on the social media front. On the political side, we were concerned about the alienation of citizens and apathy among youth. in economics, global recession, and interestingly enough, I think we were our client in Canberra was the only department which actually anticipated the GFC as a result of the work we did in our scenario work. And so in economics, we talked about a global recession, and importantly, the increase in corporatization and privatization of the education sector. In culture, loss of privacy we got onto, and we also talked about political correctness. And in technology, we talked about globalizing ICT, biotech giving us control over human nature and other things. Out of curiosity, I mean, say looking back, I would say we were particularly weak on the technology front. And I think that reflected the average age of our delegates, who I love dearly, was probably something over 50 to 55. And they weren't really with it in terms of what new technology was going to do. Okay, so we work our way through all this stuff to try and get a sense of what are the key influences that are impacting the external environment in which we, the system of interest, you know, the teaching profession, are going to have to operate. And we come up with another neat little thing which we call the impacts matrix. Now, impacts is a word that I invented to try and capture one of the essences of identifying drivers of alternative futures, which is that we're interested in things which have a lot of impact. So, for instance, in the school area, demography would be a very, very important driver in terms of the future. And I use demography in a multivarious kind of way. So I'm including not just numbers of students, but also their ethnic background and so on. So that would be very important. But we're also really interested in drivers that are incredibly uncertain as to the way they might turn out. And so it may be that demography, even though that's a really important driver, certainly over the next 10 years or so, is fairly predictable. And so you'd be in a situation where if that was an influence that you were going to sort of bring into your scenario activity, it would be evident in all the futures that you imagined. So the important point here, and it's very, very simple, is we're looking for really important drivers which are uncertain as to the way they might play out, because that's how we get to alternative futures. And those we call impacts. We often, at this stage in our work, we might have 400 or 500 influences that we've brainstormed together. And I think I would be right in my memory on the open book scenarios. I think we certainly had something in the region of 350. Now, they overlap, of course. They're all connected to each other. Well, not exclusively, but I mean, it's just a big mess, really, a load of stuff. And what we do by the impacts process is to identify those influences which are really important and highly uncertain. And you will see in the thing I put up on the screen, we've identified in the top right-hand quadrant of the matrix these key drivers. Now, once we've got these drivers, we are now in a situation where we can build scenarios. And there are lots of different ways of doing it. I really like the process we used on the open book scenarios, which was less mechanical than some of the other processes I've used over the years, and I'll come back to that in a sec. What we did was we had a group of 60 people. We got them into small groups of 5 or 6, and we asked them just to pick out a couple of drivers, a couple of influences that they thought were really important, and to play around and produce a matrix based on those two drivers by setting one against the other. And we then, rather than going with one, we did, you know, one as opposed to another, we then sort of merged. We said, okay, well, let's have a look at what we've created among the roughly 10 matrices. And what are the things that are there some things that look as if they're coming up as very, very significant across more than one of the matrices? And we then this is art, not science. We just thoughts and merged and purged, and we eventually came up with a really beautiful set of scenarios. And they were not driven by two drivers, as the matrix approach suggests. And I prefer, I mean, on a personal basis, I really like this somewhat messy way of doing it, because I think you're more likely to create a set of scenarios which are going to include some really interesting surprises. I mean, the danger with scenario work is that you end up with ho-hum scenarios. That, you know, you've gone through all this activity, you've done all this chatting, you've done all the sort of prospecting about the way the world might turn out, etc., etc., and then you come up with something which looked fairly, fairly ordinary. But we didn't. We came up with some things that are special. And we moved then from the influence map, which is what the impacts create, to a plausible world. And we came up with four of them. I'm going to run through these now because I like them. Anyway, the first one was called Under the Volcano. Because we're the teachers and it's the open book scenarios, we decided to use book titles as a way of describing each of the scenarios. So Under the Volcano is a rather horrendous novel by Malcolm Lowry, who died of drink, I think, eventually. And what we had here was the big driver here was a generational shift. So we were really getting hold of the idea. Bear in mind, in 2006 and 7, when we did this work, we weren't that far into the whole idea of, you know, Gen X, Gen Y, millennials, etc., etc. It was fairly new sort of stuff. But we really did focus on the impact of generational shift. The mood for this particular future was one of resentment. We saw it as being an evolutionary development from today. We thought the impact would be eclectic. And we identified what we called a change epicenter. So where was this happening? And we were saying, well, it's happening all over Australia. It's not just happening in Sydney or Melbourne or somewhere else. The shock influences, as I mentioned, were the generational shift. There's a definite underclass, a lot of people going to jail. Technology is everything. There's loads of global bilateralism. So globalization isn't working out quite as multilaterally as we might have thought. And we end up with a scenario that is individualistic, hedonistic. It's innovative, but it's got fault lines, and it looks as if we're heading for trouble. So that was the first of the four scenarios. The second one was called A Farewell to Arms. And this one was, this is really the cuddly scenario. The mood was optimistic. This is a big shift from today because, you know, I have to use the words carefully because I don't want to be accused of sort of getting into the wrong space. But what we were really on about was the feminization of values in the way the educational system was being run. We saw the link to the present day as being discontinuous. We think this is a global issue rather than just a national one, that the influences would be being felt from all parts of the globe. And once again, we saw this as a fairly eclectic kind of future. The world that is not a good, you know, is not in good shape. There's a lot of crisis in terms of trust and security. There is increasing divide between the haves and the have-nots, and environmental degradation is significant. The interesting thing is, you know, of the four scenarios, this one feels most like where we seem to have come over the last 10 years. And yet the consequent scenario, which this is about, hasn't happened. So we're waiting to see whether the feminization of values, the collaborative sort of aspect of this world, and its decentralization and the focus on social economics, whether all these things might emerge. There's hope. It is worth pointing out at this stage is that some scenarios have a strong utopian kind of feel to them, We try not to indicate a preference for one scenario or another. We try and sort of see them emerge relatively objectively. But you can't help liking some futures more than others. And, you know, this is the future I like. And I would say, if I think about what's happening in the world, not in the world of education, but if I think about what's happening in the Middle East and ISIS and all the crap that's going on there, I see an enormous requirement for something like this scenario, the feminization of values. In fact, you know, this is a political statement, and you needn't quote me on it. I think the future of the Muslim world is in the hands of Muslim women, and unless they can get themselves together to do something about the disastrous situation they find themselves in, will God help them and us? Mm. Okay, the next scenario, Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain, and this is called the Magic Mountain because it relates to this is my old brain failing to remember. What's the every year there's a business convention in
Davos.
That's it. The Magic Mountain is Davos, which in Thomas Mann's novel was where his hero went to die of TB. But we use the Magic Mountain because of Davos. And this scenario is straightforward. It's about the privatization and corporatizing of education. The mood is ambivalent. We see this as being an evolutionary move from the present day rather than a radical shift. We think it's a polarizing development and will have the impact of separating the haves from the have-nots and emphasizing that division. And once again, you know, we see that what we call the change epicenter for this scenario as being national. This is not just happening in Sydney or Melbourne. Although you might probably argue that there might be an emphasis in the big cities where the impact of the Magic Mountain would be greater. The shock influences in this scenario are the free market, the belief in the free market as a rationalizing force. There'd be corporate tribalism, business rules, cynicism, shrinking government, and you know, there's quite a lot about this scenario has emerged, and certainly in terms of what Christopher Pyne's been trying to do in the university sector would fit very nicely in this world. But there is a sort of growing concern about the fact that we've lost sight of the public good. And in this scenario, the public good is clearly subservient to other interests. And we also noted in this scenario the commercialization of sustainability as a process. I can't remember why. This is 10 years ago, why we put in the rise of the BRICS. Maybe we thought we ought to touch our cap towards the world that's coming along, and it has since moved along very, very strongly. And the last thing about the scenario was this whole idea of corporatized governance of education. So that was our third and our last. So we have to have something really gloomy. It's called The Grapes of Wrath. So John Steinbeck, obviously. Here we have a very pessimistic world. It's discontinuous in terms of where we are now. The change epicenter is local. I mean, one of the ironies in this world is that schools become really important social places at the local level, and there's a sense in which schools are a final sort of bastion, again, in a world that's really out of control. So this is a fear scenario. There's global recession, urban tribalism, illegal immigration, and so on. The consequent scenario is life is really like a local fortress. And this particular scenario keeps coming up in the book I mentioned, which I wrote with Richard Watson. We had a scenario called Helter Skelter, which was exactly this scenario. It's about the world, you know, you're going to hell in a handbasket, really. There's economic misery. We had, in fact, our the people we were working with, by that I mean the bureaucrats, didn't like. We came up with this fantastic idea of pod cities. So this would, we had this image of, is it Albert Park in Melbourne?
Yeah.
Yeah, actually becoming like a tented area because people had nowhere to go. Ah. And they made these little pods and they were growing tomatoes and doing all sorts of things. The, you know, like a lot of discontinuous and difficult futures, there was some focus on kinship and indigenous values. And it's interesting, I just tell a little story. In the that must have been the late 70s, I was working in St Albans, which is just north of London, and there was a flash flood. I was living in West Hampstead, and I drove home. I couldn't get into the street where I lived because it was full of water. I mean, it was literally up to your neck. So I parked as near as I could get. I then managed to swim in my suit down the street. We were in a tall building. We were fortunately on we were on the ground floor, but it was elevated. And all the basement flats in the street were flooded. And, you know, our neighbour down below, their goldfish, she was really worried because she'd lost her goldfish because he'd swum out the front door and gone somewhere. Anyway, it was a big mess. But people were incredibly connected and helpful. And, you know, scotch was being poured and people were being dried and other people were being cuddled, all of those things. And we ended up, after it all subsided, in the pub. And there's this woman who lived in the street parallel to where I was living. And she said, Oliver, she said, you know, that's been a terrible, terrible day, but I haven't had as much fun since the Blitz. And I thought that was such a genuine insight into human nature. So the point I'm making is, you know, these hairy sort of dystopic scenarios do have some upsides and some benefits. Okay, the last bit before I finish is the T in Quest, which is the whole process of looking into the consequences of the scenarios that we've built. And this is a critical step, and it's in many ways the most difficult step, because what we're trying to get people to do is to imagine a future and then to use that imagining, or imagine multiple futures, and to use that imagining in order to create a set of strategies that are useful today. So what we do is we usually identify what we call, I'm going to go on a little bit here, yes, strategic domains. So I'm going to start there. So for any system of interest, we say, where are the areas in which you can make decisions? Because, you know, there's no point in us thinking about strategies which we can't implement. We might, you know, through the process of, say, lobbying, we might have some impact on government to get people, you know, to do stuff that we think needs doing. And that's a valuable activity. But we really want to focus on the areas where we have the capacity to act. So for the teaching profession, we came up with 6 specific strategic domains. They were professional preparation, teaching practices, professional identity, community engagement, professional learning, and professional leadership. And we then had subsets for each of those. We had topics that sat underneath them. And we then got into this really, really big conversation. Given those 4 scenarios, what would we be doing in each of these areas in terms of action? And the importance about this is what we're doing is we're moving from contemplating how the world might turn out in the future to bring it back to the present, to think about the sort of things we should do now in case those particular futures emerge. Now, there are some important safety valves you have to put in place to make this happen effectively. And the first thing is to identify strategies which are common to all scenarios. And we call those the no-brainers. So we will actually, we'll take a strategy and we'll give it a value in each of the 4 worlds. And if we've got something that comes up in all imagined futures, we say, lock it in, we have to do that. We'll then have the opposite extreme we'll have a strategy that's only relevant to one scenario. And we won't lock that in unless that particular scenario is emerging. And then there's everything between those two positions. And in order to give that some sense, we like to identify what we call early warning indicators. So we'll take each of the scenarios and we'll identify with our group what would be the indicators that that world was emerging. Because you need some process for identifying when a particular set of strategies that relates to, say, the Grapes of Wrath scenario, when might be a situation when we would have to start implementing things in that area. I've just finished a second part of a project with the State Library in New South Wales. In 2010, we produced a set of scenarios called the bookend scenarios relating to the future of public libraries. And they're pretty good, even though I've said myself. They got very, very well received, both in Australia and overseas. And last year, which was the 75th birthday of the passing of the New South Wales Public Library Act, I was asked to come back and have a look at the scenarios and see how things have progressed over the last 5 years. And we produced a follow-up, which is called Building on the Bookend Scenarios. You can't update scenarios, they just are what they are. But what we did do was to take the early warning indicators that we created in 2010 and measure the extent to which they were actually happening. And that's a really interesting, we've never done that before. It was a really interesting exercise, and we ended up with a whole load of early warning indicators for each scenario with a score as to how, the extent to which they were coming into play. And what was interesting about that process, apart from the fact that it was the first time, was that there were elements in all the scenarios where there had been development, which is actually what you would expect. Because at the end of the day, scenarios are abstractions, and they tend to reflect a whole range of things, and you don't expect one scenario suddenly to come into being sort of fully fledged on its own. That probably is not going to happen. So anyway, that's the quest process. And I'm probably not going to say too much more. I think I've said my bit, really. So are there any questions that you'd like to ask?